This is an interview that I, Connie Barlow, and Michael Dow recorded in May 2011 with Deirdre Barrett, a psychologist at Harvard Medical School and the author of two practically important books in evolutionary psychology, Wasteland and Supernormal Stimuli.
Deirdre, if you could just start by sharing a little bit of your own story, your background. How did you get into this work? What was it that inspired you? Where were the ahas or the epiphanies? Like a little bit of your narrative of how you came to be who and where you are now, both personally and professionally.
And for many years, you've been one of the leaders in understanding the functional roles of dreaming. Dreaming that leads to creative breakthroughs and even dreaming that leads to the processing of grief. And you've published a couple books on that at conferences. I mean, you've really done a lot with the practical benefits of dreaming. And so now you're into an area that's a very rich field in evolutionary psychology with your book, Supernormal Stimuli, How Primal Urges Overran Their Evolutionary Purpose. That's your 2010 book. So could you talk a little bit about how you made that transition from all your work you've done as a psychologist doing research and teaching at Harvard Medical School? Tell us about how you made that transition.
I think really the only link between my long-term lifelong dream interest and the evolutionary psychology is that I've definitely become more and more explicit in thinking about dreams in terms of having an adaptive problem-solving function, and my thinking about dreams has become more and more evolutionary, which, of course, just reinterested me in all of evolutionary psychology. Ever since becoming familiar with Darwin's theories as a kid, and then with the ethologists like Tinbergen and Lorenz when I was in college, I was just always struck by how much that had to say about human behavior and psychology and the field that I was in. And Darwin certainly recognized that in his second book about emotion and man and animals. He talks pretty explicitly about behavior evolving also. But anyway, I was always interested in that, and I think in an informal sense, I've always thought about psychology from a fairly evolutionary approach. But when I was in graduate school, there was nothing explicitly called that, and I was in a fairly traditional clinical psych program. So it was really relatively late into my career that I discovered that this whole branch of psychology, calling itself evolutionary psychology, had started and had a journal and quite a literature by that time. So I kind of developed my own thinking a little bit differently from where standard evolutionary psychology has gone, and with more emphasis on the contributions of the ethologists specifically. But I've then backtracked and caught up on everything they have to say, which I very much admire.
That's great.
That's great.
Wow. Well, that was a great introductory background there. For those people who are more familiar with evolutionary psychology, one of the things that I view that you have done is that you have immediately gone, boom, right into the range of making it practical and over something that, to my knowledge, there's nobody within the sometimes contentious field of evolutionary psychology that is disagreeing with you on. I mean, the notion of supernormal stimuli you picked up from Nico Tinbergen in the 1930s, I think it was, correct?
Yes. Yes. I mean, I very much admire most of what standard evolutionary psychology has written about and said, but most of the people developing it have not tended to be clinical psychologists, so I tend to bring a more applied, wanting to help people change thought to it. And also, I especially admire Tinbergen and Lorenz and the ethology movement and think that they have even more things than just Darwin originally to say that are very applicable to human beings and human behavior and to the mismatch between instincts and modern society. And somehow that's one thread that hasn't gotten picked up in standard evolutionary psychology. So that's the whole reason I wrote the Supernormal Stimuli book, to introduce the title concept, but also a lot of things from ethology into the evolutionary psychology discussion.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that it's actually that precise point that we find it with audiences when we speak on, I mean, we've been speaking on evolution for years, and in the last 7 or 8 years, we've been really getting into more of the evolution of psychology. But the practical benefit of just, you know, mismatched instincts, living in a world of supernormal stimuli, and then explaining a little bit about what that is, that's where people so get that their own struggles, their own difficulties, their inner temptations and urges, and where they shoot themselves in the foot and fall down on their own commitments and all that kind of stuff, they start being able to look at that from a very different place rather than one of confusion or judgment or guilt. They can start have an appreciation that, oh, I've got mismatched instincts and I am surrounded by supernormal stimuli.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of people think of evolution as kind of saying that you can trust your instincts, that, you know, instincts are there to show you what's adaptive, and they don't get the piece that that's only true in our original natural setting, which we're not hardly in these days. And so the concept of supernormal stimuli, the idea that there can be an artificial object that pulls instincts more strongly than the original objects for which they evolved, is just key to understanding everything that's gone wrong in modern society and allows our instincts to lead us astray.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we have sort of our own sort of pet ways of introducing those concepts, but I'm sure you do too. I'd love to hear if you could just share a little bit about what ways you found most effective to introduce students, to introduce people of any age, to the concept of mismatched instincts and the understanding of supernormal stimuli.
I think that as soon as you begin to describe some of Nico Tinbergen's original research on supernormal stimuli, where he was first ferrying eggs to see what fake eggs he could get a bird to sit on in preference to its own, making them larger did it, making them brighter colors of the same shade that their own eggs were, if they were speckled, putting big polka dots on them so that he could get a bird to sit on a bright day-glow blue polka dot dummy egg and ignore its own little light blue dappled eggs. When you describe a few of those trying to mate with a cardboard butterfly if its stripes are more pronounced than a real butterfly, or fighting with a wooden fish that's floating into its territory if its underside is brighter red than a real fish, a few of those examples of these really primitive looking things that animals do that just illustrate that they're sometimes not at all responding to the gestalt of an attacking male fish, but just bright red underside, or not to the gestalt of what's a healthy egg, but to blueness and bigness. A few of those examples, and it's really a very obvious leap to all of the things that humans do in our artificial environment by way of choosing to eat cheeseburgers and French fries instead of leafy vegetables and fish or nuts, or liking porn and spending huge amounts of time looking at it instead of real people, or all the cute stuffed animals that people will be cooing over and spending money on are just all exaggerations of really simple stimuli that are there to pull us toward nurturing or human relationships or nutritious food, and they've all gone astray.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, one of the things that I so appreciated about your book is being a woman. When I naturally think about supernormal stimuli, okay, I think about foods, I think about drugs, I think about alcohol, all those kinds of things that did not exist in the concentrations or the mixtures 10,000 years ago for all of our ancestors. And I tend to get a little bit smug about, you know, the tremendous internet porn problem for young men and older men. And as a woman, I think, well, you know, puh, that's the men. They're just like really falling down there. And what you did in your book, which was so wonderful, is you're bringing us women sort of up to the bar and saying, hey, women, look at yourself too. What do you think's going on when you're reading all those romance novels or you have to see your soap opera every day, or you've got this insatiable urge to collect these little collectible dolls and little stuffed animals with the big eyes, and your book did a wonderful job of basically showing us that we're all in the same boat. We've all got one thing or another that it may not be unacceptable to society. That is, we women may be able to show that we're reading a romance novel when we're on the subway and a man can't pull out his Playboy magazine. But nonetheless, we are still there where we're having some of our energies and time diverted in a way that may not be healthy overall for us and our relations. So I think it's pretty obvious how the internet porn thing can become a problem, but could you talk a little bit about the female side that I just mentioned here and how that can turn out to be unhealthy for us too?
Well, I think that even though we're just much more aware of porn as a social problem and it's much more openly criticized, that there's a very equivalent cuteness porn, that's essentially what stuffed animals and anime figures and the exaggerated cuteness that's not on creatures we actually need to nurture. It's on inanimate objects, and yet it's pulling our nurturing instincts very analogously to the way that porn pulls sexual instincts. And then for women, the even closer analogy is things like romance novels and soap operas as pulling sort of the romantic interests, that clearly the instincts are there to connect us with real people, and yet this is getting diverted to reading the books that have plots that pull these instincts even more than an average real interaction will. It's very analogous to porn, and I think that any negative effects are similar. They're not as dire as stimuli that pull our aggressive instincts astray or even that have us eating very toxic things, but they're mainly a time waste. And people can afford to waste a certain amount of time on stuffed animals or pornography or romance novels, but the amount of time that a lot of people spend on some of those things is probably a serious diversion of energy away from social relationships.
Could there also be something, whether we cognitively recognize it or not, where our standards for what we view is minimally acceptable and desirable for us in the terms of sexual or emotional partner is shifted not only by internet porn, where people get to see the best bodies in the world and the women doing whatever the man wants without the man having to necessarily reciprocate, but for romance novels, one of the things that I've been thinking about for a while is whether it can be a detriment to women in that their expectations of potential partners will be just like the heroine in that romance novel, where she doesn't have to be that great herself. She doesn't have to do anything extraordinary, but all of a sudden this superb, terrific guy comes out of nowhere and sees her as the only person in the world and will obviously never, you know, she'll never have to worry about infidelity because this guy is just hers. I mean, is that part of the problem too, in the same way that internet porn can make us not as enthusiastic about the bodies of our partners?
Exactly. I think that porn and romance novels are not only supernormal stimuli in the sense that the portrayed partner is very exaggerated, either in their body shape for the porn or sexual enthusiasm in the porn or their prowess in the world and romantic immediate interest in the protagonist in the romance novel. It's not only that you have this kind of super partner portrayed, but we also have instincts to avoid getting rejected and to not expend unnecessary energy. And they're kind of supernormal in that sense too, that you just pick up the book and start reading and all of these, you know, kind of social stimuli come at you with very little effort, and there's zero chance of getting rejected by the actress on the porn flick or the guy you're fantasizing about as you put yourself into the novels. So they sort of maximize some of the social payoffs while minimizing. And you see that with anything that's pulling more general social instincts, which I think a lot of television and film is not about social or romantic strivings per se, but is about just all kinds of connection with other people. And again, you just have more friendly faces smiling at you and making friendly conversation, and you know, shows are even titled things like Friends. And there's this sort of illusion sitting in front of this screen that you're kind of part of this little social group where everybody likes each other and everybody is making this entertaining social conversation. And again, there's just zero chance of getting rejected by these people because they're not real and they're not really perceiving you. But the laugh track and the smiles and the eye contact with the camera all stimulate your instincts as if they were.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, this thing about rejection, I think, is really, really important because, of course, one of the supernormal stimuli, particularly for young men, is gaming. And I was talking with a young man who had had a lot of kind of addictive relationship to gaming when he was younger, but he's out of it now. But he said one of the things that's so attractive about gaming is that if you make a mistake, well, I mean, you can make a mistake and you're dead, but then you get to come back again. But if you make a mistake socially, and so you're shamed, or you've just done a faux pas, and so your peers in that gaming world reject you and don't want to be on the same team as you, you can always come back under a new avatar, a new name. You get a whole fresh start, a whole rebirth. And so you're not carrying around the baggage of your past mistakes. And I just never thought of it that way before.
Yeah, I think that in the artificial world of games or the less interactive things where somebody's just completely vicariously watching it on television, that you get a lot of the payoffs in instincts being stimulated without any of the risks, whether you're talking about those physical risks of doing exciting, thrilling physical things with zero chance of getting injured, or whether you're talking about fascinating, socially thrilling things with zero chance of getting rejected.
Yeah, that's a good point. I know that as a counselor, I pastored three churches over the course of a decade and have also been involved in 12-step work and sort of personal coaching and did some work with Landmark Education. So basically, I've been in sort of the personal empowerment and personal development world for a long time and have counseled or coached a lot of people, a lot of men especially, who really had difficulty in their relationships. And there was a direct connection with the way they had sort of patterned their brain's expectation, their internal visual world, mostly around porn, where they couldn't sort of get excited without envisioning certain scenarios or situations. And it really had an impact on their real life. I mean, there's a major cost to this supernormal stimuli, to a lot of it. And it's not just the person who gets addicted to heroin or addicted to alcohol or addicted to something, but it's also the way it patterns our thinking. And I'm wondering if you could say a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think that supernormal stimuli like pornography or romance novels, they both portray such exaggerated partner characteristics that they may change people's expectations or desires in that direction. But also they're so passive that to the extent they model things, they're not realistic things. But also you're just not getting any practice with your side of social interactions. That those are sort of effortless and passive. And so then when you get out in the real world, I think you not only have this kind of false image of what's been modeled, but you also, I mean, practice is much better than simple observation for learning social skills.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Well, you know, along those lines, one of the things that we've found is that in terms of people who turn on to this idea and find some emotional, psychological relief in having a new perspective, that some of the challenges in their life, in the lives of their loved ones, or in their relationships, owe really to one form or another of mismatched instincts that we all share universally as evolved humans. We all bring these ancient instincts with us, these Stone Age instincts, and that we're surrounded by supernormal stimuli that I even go back just to my grandparents' generation growing up in rural Hungary in dirt floor shacks. I mean, They had almost no supernormal stimuli, even just two generations back from me, compared to what we in America in our modern world have. And so what Michael and I have found is that if we just have 15 minutes to tell people about this, there's a lifting of a sense of self-condemnation or condemning others that is almost a spiritual, what could be termed a spiritual experience. And I'm wondering if you've felt this in your own work when you come to people who are troubled either with their own attachment to supernormal stimuli or because they've been judging, condemning loved ones for being addicted to this, that, or the other thing, that they too have this sort of lightening up of, oh my gosh, I mean, it's really not at base that everybody's sinful, but that we're dealing with things that our brains did not evolve to help us to handle.
Yes, I definitely find that the concept of supernormal stimuli seems to just kind of set off a light bulb in a lot of people in beginning to identify things that way and then making it much easier to think about how to avoid them and also to get much more serious about needing to avoid them once they get the concept of this really does pull stronger than the natural object and yet it is not the natural object and it's not what the instinct was developed for and you can reason out what the natural thing is. That, I mean, we really do have enormous willpower and ability to override our simpler instincts, but I think we just haven't been applying those very well to things like food and exercise and real social activities versus some empty entertainment things. Because really, most people, most of the time, stay away from hard drugs. I mean, they know those are unnatural. They probably know that heroin would feel good if they tried it, but they're not about to because they know it's unnatural and bad for you and would have a strong pull. And yet, when you're talking about cheeseburgers or ice cream or spending lots of time watching sitcoms on television, they just don't think about it that way. Those things feel natural and feel good, and why not? And once they start seeing the more overarching principle, I think it makes it easier to start applying that willpower to a lot more things.
Yeah. You know, in addition to willpower, one of the things that I don't recall seeing in your book, but I'm imagining that it is there for you, so I want to sort of test this out. We've found that the difference that makes the difference for many, many people is the shift from self-condemnation, self-judgment, guilt, shame, secrecy, confusion, all that kind of stuff, to one of, oh, wow, you mean I wouldn't be alive if my ancestors didn't have these very same instincts that I find problematic? That shift to gratitude that people can get from a deep time perspective, from an evolved understanding of our instincts, our physical instincts, our social instincts, and our interpretive instincts, that we actually are instinctually programmed to be self-deceptive. When people get that, they can then, in my experience, find gratitude. And it's like that old adage, what you resist persists. Well, in my experience, what you can be grateful for makes it so much easier to transform. It's not only about willpower, but it's the willpower that is unleashed or unlocked as a result of coming after a sense of gratitude that I no longer need to feel shameful or guilty or confused about my inner nature and why I've got these inner struggles and temptations. But it's like, oh, duh, of course I do. And then I can make wiser choices because I'm not locked into making myself wrong, which helps keep the dysfunctional pattern in place. So I'm just wondering if you have anything that you'd like to add to that in terms of the gratitude or appreciation piece.
Yes, I mean, I think just everyone identifies with the concept of supernormal stimuli once it's explained that at least one of those, the cuteness pull, the sugar, salt, fatty food pull, the rest when you don't need to exercise pull, that at least several of those resonate for lots of people. It just gives them more of a sense of unity with the same struggle that other people are having. I think sometimes more compassion for some of the people struggling with the more serious and the more stigmatized ones like drug addiction, but also just a certain insight, aha, this is just basic human biology that everyone shares, but an also immediate, here's the way around it kind of answer.
Yeah. I remember in New Orleans about 4 or 5 years ago, there was a woman who was just getting her doctorate in neurobiology. And she came up to Connie after her program, and she said, the amazing thing is the more I learn about the brain and how our minds work and how our instincts work, she said, the more compassion that I have for myself and others. And then she paused and she said, isn't it amazing and somewhat ironic that science is giving us access to this traditional spiritual virtue?
Yeah, but I think definitely that understanding some of the basic sort of ethological ideas about how instincts work in animals and man give us a lot more compassion and a lot less judgmental sense about those things.
Yeah, amen.
I think that all of the ethology research that Lorenz and Tinbergen did, and especially Tinbergen's work on supernormal stimuli, that they all illuminate that basic instincts toward one physical drive for sex or food or conservation of energy, and that we completely share those with pretty much all animal species. And then really, most animal species don't have a good end run around that. When the bird is coded to sit on the biggest egg it can find or the bluest egg it can find, it's really stuck if an experimenter puts this dummy out there. It's simply going to hop on the dummy and slide off and hop on the dummy again and not hatch its own egg. And it doesn't have other resources. Whereas we do have what you're calling the interpretive instincts, the higher cortical functions, especially our prefrontal cortex, has developed specifically to make end runs around those fairly simplistic physical instincts. So when we find ourselves pulled towards something that's not good for us, we need to be able to identify that that's the case. But once we do, we have the resources to say, hey, no, I won't just eat all the sweets that taste good or all the salty stuff that tastes good or watch porn on my computer all day. You know, I'll make a decision to do something that's more adaptive. And we can do that, whereas that is where humans are different from most other animals.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing, Deirdre, that you were mentioning about how this is being brought in and what it's doing for people, Michael and I, ever since we kind of landed on this evolutionary psychology and then got brought into the mismatched instincts, and then really February 2010, when your book, Supernormal Stimuli, came out, we felt like that was a vital piece in the puzzle that we were missing. And so Michael, he normally does our outreach programs and has this wonderful concept of how we would like to see all the 12-step programs that end in anonymous get to the point where it's no longer shameful. There's nothing, it's not like this is something is sinful or something about us that shouldn't be and that's bad. But Michael has a funny way of saying how he'd like to have people, when they come to a 12-step program, how they'd like to introduce themselves.
Yeah, after I've introduced the concept of mismatched instincts and supernormal stimuli, and there's a few places where I kind of always get laughs. For example, after I introduce supernormal stimuli, I have a picture of French fries, and I'll say, now, in case it's not obvious, folks, this is not food. This is the concentration of food-like items that we are evolutionarily programmed to want and to want more of. But then I go on to say, you know, it takes a lot of courage in our culture to walk into a group of strangers and say, hi, my name is Michael, I'm an alcoholic, or hi, I'm Michael, I'm a codependent, or I'm a gambling addict, or a sex addict. What's true is that, hi, my name is Michael, and I'm a human being with mismatched instincts surrounded by supernormal stimuli. And you know something? That's true for you, too. And I just pause, and it's like everybody gets it. It's like it removes the stigma.
Yeah, and certainly, I mean, some instincts are more attached to shame in society, and it is a lot easier to say, hi, I love French fries, hi, I watch 4 hours of sitcoms on television. You know, those are not particularly adaptive behaviors, but they're not terribly shame-associated behaviors. And certainly sexual instincts, number one, but I think some of the other supernormal stimuli are certainly much more difficult to talk to and more stigmatized. I remember when my 2007 book, Wasteland, had come out.
Spell your book, Wasteland, because other people won't know how you spell it.
Wasteland. And it was pretty much focused on supernormal stimuli, but mainly as they manifest in food choices and in exercise or lack thereof choices, and just all about how supernormal stimuli impact on physical health. And I was doing a radio show about it, and the host said something about me not liking fat people, I believe was his phrasing. And he said, well, you compare them to drug addicts. And I just realized, I think coming from the field of clinical psychology, really most people in the field have a lot of compassion for drug addicts. It's not, you know, your first association is kind of one of the more difficult problems to deal with, not bad person. But out there in maybe the most average part of the world, drug addicts are very stigmatized, and overeaters are maybe mildly stigmatized, but much less so. But it's really having plenty of compassion for both while still seeing them as operating on very similar principles.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I want to use that as an opportunity to go back to something that you said a few minutes ago. Say a little bit about this draw or this pull of rest after exercise.
Our ancestors on the savanna probably got all the exercise that they needed as they were hunting game and gathering vegetation and building their shelter, and, you know, even caring for children was a more physical undertaking in those days. So there wasn't any real strong need for an impulse toward exercise for its own sake. We had impulses to chase down food and do other productive activities that involved exercise. So now that we have all of these energy-saving devices and ways of doing things, very little human physical exercise is required to gather huge meals for yourself. And even things like childcare, which are still very effortful in one sense, are less physically effortful on average. So our instincts are coded to tell us to rest when we don't need to be exercising. On the savanna for hunter-gatherers, that would have been the adaptive thing, when you're not chasing down your food or chasing down your 2-year-old or building your house, you might as well rest. But now we've got these impulses saying, well, if there's no strong reason to exercise, why don't you rest right now, sort of all the time.
You know, one of the things in this whole thing of bringing up what our ancestors had to deal with, my hope is that we'll start having it so that even kids in elementary school, before they have to confront the problems of, let's say, an alcoholic parent or themselves or their friends having the temptation of drug addiction, they'll be able to witness in themselves. They'll be able to make that distinction of course, there's part of me that's being drawn towards this. And of course that's happening because my ancestors never had that opportunity. Or like my ancestors in Hungary, I know one of the things it's done for my appreciation is that my ancestors, or coming from the Hungarian lineage, our side of the family has a lot of problem with type 2 diabetes. And that's because my ancestors survived because their metabolism adapted to where they could hold on to their fat, and they made use of everything during the famines. And those people that didn't have that genetic predisposition got lost. So here my grandfather shows up in America for the first time, and he never has a famine. And so, of course, he develops type 2 diabetes, and so does my mother. And so instead of me condemning, like, why does this genetic thing have to exist, I go, oh, without it, my poor grandparents and their grandparents and their grandparents before that never would have survived and reproduced. I couldn't be here without it. That appreciation is such a thing that I guess what I'm saying is that I'm really hoping that even for, as you put it, the things that are still most shameful in our society, let's say somebody's addicted to painkillers or alcohol and yet is very successful in their business, or is a church elder, they're not allowed to say it at all. But if we can get it to the point where it's not shameful, then I think it'll be possible to get people into recovery programs much, much sooner, because there's not that scariness of denial. It's like, oh, I can't possibly be an alcoholic. I can't possibly be an addict. I can't let anybody know this, because otherwise I'll be judged. And I'm wondering, you as a professional, have you seen it starting to penetrate drug addiction and alcohol programs that, like you say, where people feel they have to be anonymous? Is this starting to help get more people get assistance and feel less shameful about it?
Thinking about it as supernormal stimuli, for the areas that are likelier to already have shame as a big factor, like drug use and sexual addictions, that's one of the biggest factors, just realizing that these are natural impulses, lowers the shame and ability to talk about it. Whereas I think for some of the lower stigma addictions, such as overeating or watching many, many hours of television per day, that those haven't been that stigmatized, but they haven't been as clearly identified as a problem, or even if they're vaguely seen as a problem, what the problem is, that you're feeling pulled toward something that's an unnatural object that's grabbing your instincts too strongly, hasn't been identified. So I think that for the highly stigmatized ones, they're already trying to change, and it's more sort of that it takes some of the shame away. And for the lower stigma ones, I think it just makes it clearer in identifying that there's a problem and what the approach to solving it might be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. When you just shared that, it reminded me of something that I hadn't thought of in a long time, which is when I was 20 years old, something like that. I mean, in 1979, long before I had any understanding of our evolved nature, I really got how addictive television could be and was. And I think part of that came from, I broke both of my legs when I was 16, and I had my legs up in a cast, and so I watched a lot of TV, and I became addicted to soap operas and other TV stuff. And then by the time I was, I think, 19 or 20, I realized this is just not serving my life, and basically made a decision to break the addiction to television. And in the last 30 years, if I watch two or three programs a year, it's a lot. I mean, I'll watch some special program, and we watch movies, of course, but I don't watch TV. In fact, my kids growing up, we didn't have a cable or an antenna because I didn't want that TV addiction. And there is no stigma against it. It's sort of normal American culture. We feed our minds and we feed the habits of our bodies with this machine.
Yeah, I think that's a great example, because certainly people get pulled to supernormal stimuli anyway, but I do hear so many stories where somebody gets sick for a while and sort of can't participate in their just more sort of usual exercise of their instincts, or they're depressed, or they break up a relationship. Anyway, they sort of go through some disruption of their normal routine, and they start overeating junk food, or they start watching more television, or they start watching a significant amount of porn for the first time. And then there's definitely this addictive quality that kicks in. It's so much less effort than going after the natural stimuli. And so it's often when the natural stimuli get a little bit disrupted in their influence on one's life that people seem to get into the worst situations with the supernormal ones.
One of the things that I hear in your voice that I love in everything you do, and certainly in your book, is that on the one hand, when someone is first being introduced to not only the fact of supernormal stimuli and why it exists, but as you do, laying out all the places that we had never thought before were actually problematic from a supernormal stimuli basis, it can actually be troubling. It can be actually a little bit like, I really don't want to know this. And yet you have a real sense of hope in your voice. And so I'm curious if you could tell us a little bit about how you yourself have moved through that some people are very hesitant to learn more about our evolutionary history because they think it's going to show that we're all, you know, just warriors and trying to compete and kill each other and all, you know, this kind of caricature of how the evolutionary world works. And I'd like to hear from you, where do you get your hope as being one of the leading researchers in evolutionary psychology and certainly the leading person on having synthesized and assembled this whole understanding of supernormal stimuli.
My sense of hope comes from the fact that I think that all along that things that people haven't literally labeled as supernormal stimuli but sort of recognize as having an unnatural pull, like drugs, not that no one in our society has problems with drugs, but the majority of people stay away from drugs exactly because they are this abnormal thing that they know has a very powerful pull, and their just intellectual desire to resist that kicks in from day one. And I think that with some other things like tobacco that were at one point viewed as very innocuous and sort of fell under the rubric of, oh, if my instinct is, you know, to like this, then it must be good, you know, that we gradually began to realize how dangerous it was, that there was kind of a turning point where, and I think it was in some of the advertising tobacco to children, in just, you know, one cancer study too many, that people really got serious about tobacco as a major, major health threat. And we've really seen a turnaround. I can remember when I was a kid, people saying, well, you can't tell people they can't smoke in a restaurant. They're adults. And now, well, yes, we can. We've just had a huge turnaround in how we feel about taxing it, prohibiting it completely in some places, getting really serious about people who are trying to push cigarettes to children. And we really see rapidly declining smoking and gradually declining rates of lung cancer and other things. I think that we're getting close to that point with at least some of our problem food issues. I mean, you already see trans fats starting to get banned in some locales. I think it's going to take a little bit more, and that actually the bad foods are going to get a bit worse before we really come to that general turning point about it. But I can kind of see the first signs of that. You know, well, you can't prohibit sweets to adults. You know, we may be taxing things similarly to cigarettes and prohibiting certain kinds of advertising and certainly putting positive incentives toward developing healthier foods.
I know that there's been a great push in a lot of school districts to not have soda pops, the sugar of soda pops, even available in those machines, and to put a lot more attention into what goes into school lunches. So
yeah, and just like with cigarettes, I think the children issue pushes people's buttons faster than anything. The kind of, yeah, we can see that our kids don't do these unhealthy things, even if we're still going to. But our government is still subsidizing growing corn for corn syrup and not subsidizing growing broccoli and, you know, healthier things. I think we're pretty far from the main turnaround point, but it's starting.
Yeah, I agree. You mentioned the word advertising just a minute ago, and I've just started. I haven't done any deep thinking on it yet, but I'm wondering if you could say a little bit about how advertising presents itself and appeals to us using supernormal stimuli.
Yeah, well, I think just any entertainment media in general, but especially advertising, is going to tend to use supernormal stimuli. And I mean, first of all, lots of the products being advertised are supernormal stimuli, like a lot of the refined foods and entertainment programs. But even when the product isn't, sexualized advertising for completely non-sex related products, cute advertising for completely nothing to do with nurturance type products are two of the huge strategies to sell things. Sell them with something that looks sexy or sell them with something that looks cute are the number one and number two strategies. So supernormal stimuli are used just constantly in advertising.
Yeah, exactly. Deirdre, if you could share how you yourself have benefited from this understanding in your own life or relationship.
I always had the rest if you don't need to be moving outlet. I used to love that W.C. Fields quote about whenever I feel the urge to exercise, I lie down until it passes. I used to pride myself on quoting that. so until about the age of 30, when I began to put on a little weight, even though I was eating probably less than I had, you know, at age 20, and just wasn't as fit. I'd just, you know, always sort of been in very good health without working at it at all. And all of a sudden I wasn't as much. And so I had to make a very conscious effort to make myself think of some way that I was going to get exercise and get myself to the gym and do it with very much of a take your vitamins sort of mentality about it, not with a sense of fun and loving athletics. But it was definitely coming out of this thinking from the ethological and Darwinian standpoint about my body was supposed to be doing what my ancestors did, and I obviously wasn't, and I needed to remedy that. So that was kind of the biggest one for me personally, was exercise. But I know it's different for every person.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you were to speak to a person who was struggling with any form of supernormal stimuli and sort of giving them sort of a piece of coaching or where to go next. You know, they've just been turned on to this idea. The light bulb has just gone on. What would you say that would be inspiring to them or sort of a next step that you would recommend?
Just kind of practice recognizing it. You know, talk to your friends about it and start identifying supernormal stimuli in your environment and which ones are pulling you personally and which ones seem to have less effect on you, but you notice pulling other people. Because they're really all around us when you notice them. And also, they're much easier to resist when you label them that way.
Mm-hmm.
Not effortless, but certainly easier than when it is so tempting to just think of them as natural. I mean, like that bird is sitting on that giant blue egg, apparently, you know, thinking in its little bird mind that that's the healthiest egg it can possibly sit on. And when we don't question it, you know, cheeseburgers taste like good food because they're so fatty and they're so salty, and that's what we're coded to be looking for if we don't stop and think about it. But as soon as we stop and think about it, it's very clear.
That's great. That's great. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, since everybody else has confessed their supernormal stimuli, I will say mine is the drug theobromine, and you women, you know what that is. It's chocolate.
Yes.
Quite a few Lents. I'm not a Catholic. I'm actually not a Christian, but I do like the idea of having a structure for periodically showing myself that I don't need it. And so periodically for a Lent, I'll decide I'm going to go off chocolate for the period, and very proud of myself when I do that.
Actually, one thing I've discovered about that, because I like chocolate too, is that the modest amounts in cocoa powder that are combined with all the antioxidants are actually fine for you. Cocoa powder is fine for you. So if it's mixed with a kind of innocuous natural sweetener in totally non-fat milk, or all of those Mexican recipes that put it in totally non-sweet things, you know, the Mexican mm-hmm. sauces. And it's really the sugar that people are adding into it that's the main what's bad for you.
Yeah, yeah.
Good point.
Well, you know, one of the things that I have found useful in my own life, and I've also worked with people in a coaching capacity and offered it to them, is the idea that when you shift from confusion, guilt, judgment, self-condemnation, whatever, to gratitude first, that if your ancestors didn't have these same instincts that you find challenging in a world of supernormal stimuli, you wouldn't be alive. And then to begin to invite people to honor their instincts. And that's a different, you know, most people don't think about honoring. That is to sort of deeply respect and appreciate their own instincts. But when you can do that, I say this personally, when I was able to do that, once I was able to do that, I found that then setting up some kind of a pattern that allowed me to occasionally indulge in supernormal stimuli from a place of not only not feeling guilty or ashamed, but thrilled, delighted. One of the things that my kids, who are now, I've got a 27-year-old daughter, a 26-year-old son, and a 20-year-old daughter, and one of the things that we did for years growing up was that we would have what we called new moon and full moon treats. In other words, we would only allow ourselves candy or some kind of supernormal stimuli at new and full moons. And I still pretty much keep to that. I mean, at new and full moons, I'll have a big large Dairy Queen milkshake or something like that. But I don't allow myself to do that during the normal part of the month. And I only do it at that frequency because for me, that frequency really works, is that twice a month or so, I can allow myself that. Now, I don't do that with alcohol because the pull has been too strong, so I just avoid it entirely, as well as drugs. But with the supernormal stimuli that hasn't been, you know, particularly problematic, I do that. And I found that sort of setting a pattern once I've got gratitude and can honor my instincts to be really, really useful.
Yeah, I found it interesting on your site how you combine the spirituality with the Darwinism.
Yeah, yeah. Well, part of it is because in the minds of many people, there's this polar opposite. You know, you're either a religious or spiritual person, or you're a science-oriented person. And Connie and I have been attempting to show audiences for 10 years that one can be fully evidentially oriented, grounded in our best evidential understanding of reality, and have that inspire you to live a life of compassion, integrity, love, generosity, and so on. In other words, the things that typically get associated with religion or spirituality can mm-hmm. actually be fueled by an evidential science-based evolutionary worldview.
Yeah, and something I didn't talk about just now, but certainly do in the aggression chapters, I certainly believe that we have all sorts of instincts for compassion, mainly toward our own species, but to some extent for, you know, for everything in creation. And, you know, and that's just always in some kind of balance with some of the aggressive and more selfish instincts, and that certainly you can set up the environment to pull one or the other much more strongly and influence in either direction.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Deirdre, thank you so much for sharing with us today about your 2010 book, Supernormal Stimuli, How Primal Urges Overran Their Evolutionary Purpose.
And your book, Wasteland, the subtitle, The Revolutionary, with the emphasis on evolutionary, science behind our weight and fitness crisis.
So again, thank you, Deirdre.
Yes, and thank you for sharing with us your perspective on our brains and our instincts and the challenges of living in a modern world, given all that.
And possibilities for really being able to evolutionize our lives.